Hello there. This is How to Murder Time, a podcast about books and things.
Hello, everybody.
Watcher.
Hello.
I've tried a different intro today because there's far too many people on this show.
And you've been getting the intro wrong more than the last couple of things.
Wrong as well, yeah. So it's a book one again. With us this time is Daze and Torag. Say hello.
Hello, Daze and Torag.
Every time. And John. John's here as well. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, John. Hello.
Excellent. Jolly good. So this time we are doing The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert A. Heinlein. Now, I picked this one because Robert Heinlein, during his life, wrote a ridiculous number of short stories, science fiction novels and all the rest of it. And he, out of everyone so far, is the person who's won the most Hugos out of anyone. So four wins with Stranger in a Strange Land, 1962, Starship Troopers, 1960, and Double Star, 1956, and this as well, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which is 1967's win. So I thought we'd pick that one and have a crack at it. And this is, well, I'll read the back of the book and we can go from there. So another brilliant novel from the acknowledged master of science fiction. Now, this one's a bit PR heavy. On Luna, an open penal colony of the 21st century, a revolution is being plotted. The conspirators are a strange assortment, an engaging jack of all trades, his luscious blonde girlfriend, and a lonely talking computer. Their aim, the overthrow of hated authority. Everything goes well until... that doesn't really tell you an awful lot about the book at all, to be honest. Quite an old edition I've got here, so, as you can tell. this essentially is a tale of lunar rebellion. We've got lunar colonies revolting against the oppressive yoke of Earth, and a group of misfits and ne'er-do-wells banding together to seek independence and freedom for the people of the moon. It's set in 2075 AD, and at that point in time, there are about 3 million people living on the moon, which is an ex-penal colony. So a combination of convicts, ex-convicts, and second and third generation descendants of convicts, a kind of transportation punishment, a bit like Australia in the olden days. And the story opens with Manny, Manuel Garcia O'Kelly Davis, who's our narrator of the story, who is a lunar native computer technician called in to debug a strange problem with the lunar authority's mainframe master computer, and who discovers to his surprise that the thing has become sentient. It has developed a personality, and one thing leads to another, and the pair develop a bit of a friendship. The computer initially wants Manny's opinion on humor, on jokes. He starts printing off big lists of jokes for Manny to work through and to tell the computer whether these are funny sometimes or funny all the time or not funny at all. This is largely off the back of a number of practical jokes that the computer has started playing, one of which was he paid one of the employees of the authority 10 million credits too much. And so this was seen as bugs, and in gets called Manny to debug it all, and a strange friendship is born. Manny then goes on to meet Wyoming Davis as well, Wyoming not, a political agitator from one of the sort of sub-colonies elsewhere on the moon, and they get caught up in a hotbed of rebellion and ferment, which snowballs out of control and eventually leads to a struggle against the oppressors on the Earth. So, Torag, hello.
Hello there.
How did you get on with this? What do we think?
It's a lot easier to read than the Red Shirts.
Oh yes,
was.
Yes. Last time's offering.
Yeah, it was a great deal easier than that. Mm. But I was somewhat influenced by the fact that we've been inundated by politics recently.
it is
both,
a very political
in
sort
Britain
of book, yeah,
and in America. And you start off, you know, you have the beautiful blonde firebrand who has simple answers to complicated questions, and just think, yeah, but someone who everyone cheers who has simple answers, I don't trust.
Well, certainly at the beginning of the book, there's a sort of homegrown, it's almost comes across as like a sort of student politics type of rebellion or rebellious organized sort of underground thing that really haven't got a clue and not that effective at all, and that most of the authorities seem to have a handle on, seem to have spies and moles within their network, and they're just sort of just making a little bit of a rabble-rousing noise and not really having any kind of solid clue about it all. And the way Manny gets involved in all this is that the computer, Mike, actually sends Manny off to go and record the meeting because Mike's curious about these meetings and wants to know what's going on as well. So that's how Manny gets caught up in it.
Yeah, if you're going to be a secret computer who's secretly gained sentience,
yes,
and you're a Holmes computer, might it not be somewhat wise not to call yourself after one of the two famous Holmeses in history, or in the history of literature?
I can't remember if he gives him the name or whether Mike picks his own name, but basically the computer is a Holmes Mark IV something or other, and he decides that Mycroft, or shortened to Mike, is a good name. Well, it could be worse. Could have called it Sherlock, I suppose.
Yeah, grant you that. But sort of, how did he stay secret? That was the possibly unbelievable thing. I'm willing to accept, you know, the all the rest of the ludicrous things that happen, including the bizarre marriage system. But
yes.
But this computer staying secret just seemed just utterly implausible. It just
I found that myself
crashed.
Well, so, I think it's just a sign of the times. It was written in the 60s, and the politics in this are very 60s politics. It's lots of people uprising against the machine, thinking they can make a difference, and then there's that fear of technology and what is that actually doing, and with the computer manipulating things in a way, are you meant to trust it? What is actually is it? How is it sentient? Why is it sentient? And what
so that's never really explained. I mean, the entire story does sort of hinge off this Deus Ex Machina in a very literal sense. This computer, I think the sort of hand wavy explanation that Manny gives is that they kept adding more and more circuitry or whatever memories to it until eventually it reached some sort of threshold limit, like it had more processing transistors than there are axons in the human brain or something along those lines. Some sort of quite
suddenly became self-aware and began teaching itself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sort of woke up. Literally, it says he woke up.
Yes,
because plot. Yeah,
the computer Mike is presented as young at the start. You know, you get the impression that it has only just been born. So, you know, the logic of, you know, if he'd been in that state for a prolonged period of time, he'd have showed himself. Well, I think, yes, I absolutely agree. It wouldn't have made any sense.
He showed himself in a series of bugs that no one except Manny, our narrator, had the imagination to attribute to actual humour and an actual pranking. You know,
jokes that no one was getting.
Yeah, everyone else just thought it was just bugs and just, you know, just called in the guy to come and fix it. And sort of none of the people responsible or the day-to-day operators of this machine really dug in any deep. And there's a sort of utter complacency that it's just what machines do. And pretty much throughout the entire book, the only person who actually realizes that the computer is sentient is Manny, and the only other people who ever find out are people that Manny tells. So
I suppose in a way that is realistic, because I know I'm the only one of us that doesn't work in a computing field, and I'm sure that all three of you would just blame it on some stupid computer or stupid bug if something happened that didn't make sense, rather than thinking the computers were thinking for themselves.
Working in QA, I've yet to have a developer use that excuse on me, but I'm not going to take it if they do. No.
The whole book would have broken down if the governor had just decided to solve his problems at the start by turning Manny off and on again.
Yeah. Or indeed, if they had any kind of oversight or any kind of redundancy or any kind of ability to just check on the internal workings of the computer that weren't reliant on one, essentially a contractor is what Manny is. Manny doesn't work directly for the authority. Yes. Yeah, they call him in on a sort of exorbitant day rate because he's the only computer technician who lives on the moon.
And the more complicated the bugs and the acting out gets, the more they need Manny.
Yeah,
it's peculiar exactly. The contractor becomes more vital and more difficult the problems
throughout, get. Throughout the early stages of the book, Manny has Mike do various things that cause the authority to have to call Manny in. So it's like the sort of IT consultant contractor's best dream, really, isn't it? A computer that's working on your side to give you more work, you know.
I mean, to be fair, the world building of the lunar setup was quite nicely done, and you sort of can buy into the fact that they're doing this, working the whole thing on the minimum budget. They're not going to have a computer expert because you'd have to pay them all the time.
Well, it sort of makes sense
the way they'd treat it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of thought gone in by Heinlein into what would day-to-day life like be in a lunar city. I mean, a lot of explanation goes into the whole physiological one-way trip nature of going to live on the moon. If anyone from Earth who stays on the moon for like more than a month or two basically starts to suffer irreversible physiological changes, which basically mean they're pretty much unable to return to the Earth again. So that then becomes a reason why there are, you know, postings to the moon are a real problem. You can't get any of the warden and his staff. But it's all tend to be it tends to be something of a punishment detail. The troopers that they send have to be paid extra, and they don't want to go because they can if they stay too long, they never come back. You know, I mean, short trips are fine if you work out in the right sorts of gym and so on, or wear weights as you're going about your day-to-day business. But, you know, life under 1/6 gravity is really sort of explored and quite taken quite seriously by Heinlein all the way through. Yeah. I mean, all throughout the sort of first major part of the book, where we're looking at, you know, what's life like out there, you're seeing, you know, just nods to it, how people tend to walk differently, how they, you know, tourists from Earth almost always break their ankles as they come bounding down ramps, that kind of thing.
And the whole of that is really quite plausible. It does sort of fit together quite nicely. And
so, the dirty engineering of it.
Yeah.
And, but there's two things they didn't use, because they probably didn't know them at the time, which is stories I love about the idea
of
putting...
This was written this one 2 years before man walked on the moon for the first time. So it's pretty visionary for its time, yeah.
One of the stories I heard is if you have a dome on the moon, which is full of air, then you can run across the swimming pool, because if you move fast enough, you act like a pond skater. You actually don't break through the surface tension.
Oh, that's a missed trick.
And that would be great. I'd love to go to the moon just for that.
Lunar Olympics.
And apparently,
I want to walk on water.
If you
go
flap
to the moon,
your arms, if you flap your arms, you can fly.
You can literally take off. Wow.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be sort of covered a lot. But I think at one point, there's a point later in the book when they're trying to sort of work the propaganda angle of the moon as an independent colony. They're giving all sorts of reasons why it's awesome to come and live there and stuff. And I think baseball comes up quite a bit.
Oh, God, yeah. Sort of,
that American passion. Yeah, but the idea of lunar baseball and lunar Olympics and sports and stuff does come up. But then, of course, they're downplaying the downside of it all, which is that if you go to the moon for more than 2 months, you can't come home again. So... yeah, it's
of all the bits of science that sort of, you know, the permanent and lasting effects of zero G travel.
You don't normally see that explored elsewhere. Yeah. I mean, even sort of more contemporary, more hard SF works. I'm thinking, I think we'll probably see a lot of comparisons to Red Mars and Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, because that's essentially a similar tale, but on Mars. But you know, the idea that Martian gravity is 60% of the Earth's, and that's never really looked at in any solid detail. But then, of course, very few people from the Mars end up back on Earth in those books anyway. But 1/6 of the gravity is going to be significantly changing. And it's questionable whether humans could actually live under that for extreme length, long time, long periods of time, lives.
I think it's certainly true. If you're born in that environment, the chances of you being able to go back to a 6G environment and live there are fairly
six
slim.
Times the gravity. It would be
because,
quite harsh.
You know, your heart wouldn't actually be able to pump the blood because it's
that
not
does
used
actually
to that
come up
pressure.
Later in the book. There's a point where Manny and the professor, who I haven't even talked about yet, they do end up having to go to Earth. And Manny actually, he says he has been to Earth before, and he does weights and does training so that he can go to Earth on business for training and computers and such stuff like that. You know, sort of the idea that the internet doesn't really exist back in this sort of milieu. But no, I really did like the sort of exploration of a lunar colony. I mean, the overall premise for the lunar colony being there and being important in the first place is that basically the moon's being used to farm grain to be shipped to Earth, because population on Earth and starvation on Earth are such that presumably it makes economic sense to grow wheat on the moon and then wrap it in steel barrels and use a massive linear accelerator magnetic railgun type thing to fire it back to the Earth, where it sort of goes into orbit and then gets splashed down in the Indian Ocean and then parceled out to the starving of Earth. So essentially the opening of the book, the moon is essentially one massive farm working under quite penurious conditions. People on Earth don't really care. They're just, as long as the grain keeps coming, whatever, that kind of thing. It's almost like used like a sort of overseas colonial plantation, that kind of politics.
I did like the idea that there was a reason why they pushed towards revolution at this point.
Yes.
Which is that somebody pointed out to them the facts that, you know, within 8-10 years, there wouldn't be enough water left to feed the people on the moon, mm-hmm. and they'd all, you know, end up eating each other and then dying of starvation.
Yeah.
That's a good reason for everyone to start thinking it's time to do something.
Professor Bernardo de la Paz were introduced to at this revolutionary meeting that Manny's gone along to spy on Mike's behalf. This is where we meet Wyo as well. And this is, again, another sort of, not quite such an, you know, literal deus ex machina, but it's incredibly convenient that we happen to have a dissident political exile who knows about all sorts of revolutionary techniques at hand and available in this first meeting. And he's basically there telling all of these revolutionaries that they're rubbish, you know, they've got no idea, and that actually we've got to do something really serious, because the way the lunar farming works is that they find large pockets of ice under the crust of the moon. They dig that out and they use the ice to water the grain, and then they end up basically shipping large amounts of metal and fertilizers and phosphates and the native water of the moon back to the earth, and they get nothing back. There is no return traffic. They're occasionally a freighter's cargo ships come by with small amounts of refined goods, you know, trinkets and beads and so on, effectively. But yes, as you say, the whole driver of this, well, we've got to revolt because they're not sending the water back, and so our ecosystem is going to dwindle to nothing, yeah. and we'll all die.
It which was refreshing. Yeah, it was refreshing. Little old man turns up in the story and explains why they're all being stupid children.
Yeah,
and I just thought, it really needed it at that point.
But in a way, that sort of legitimizes and drives the entire of what follows. Because I mean, the revolution's essentially a bloody business, and does cost lives, is a massive upheaval, and does jeopardize the status quo immensely. And it'd be a lot harder to get behind the heroes of the story if they were doing that just out of some sense of you know, pride or whatever, or, you know, we just want the shackles off, we want to be free for its own sake. Knowing that there is a kind of matter of life and death type background to it all does sort of make them a bit more sympathetic, I think.
And the fact that most of it's sort of executed relatively bloodlessly with relatively little death, because they're using Mike to do all manner of, you know, clever subterfuges and manipulate and double blind people.
Yeah.
Without Mike, it would have been a bloody story of, well, yeah, a revolution that goes horribly wrong, probably. But
yeah.
It would have been much harder to root for the lead characters, because they would have been elbow deep in blood.
It would have been a really sort of tooth and nail thing that probably, as you say, probably wouldn't have come off. I mean, so the meeting gets raided, everyone gets scatters and in confusion, because there's spies everywhere amongst these so-called revolutionaries. So the Professor, Wyo and Manny basically debunk to a hotel room somewhere, where they then sit down and plan out a proper revolution, with the added revelation that, hang on, we got this all-knowing supercomputer that can listen in on every phones and is my friend, that can help us. And they basically, extensively use the sort of, I think in my notes I've written the phrase magical sympathetic supercomputer.
Can we just start calling me God?
Well, it is sort of, I mean, if you had that kind of computer and that of that sort on hand, then yes, all this stuff would be relatively easy to do. They basically set up, and it's quite intricate and interesting, and obviously Heinlein's given a lot of thought to the ideas of sedition and successful revolution and the sort of counter-revolutionary politics and all the rest of it, because you've got this
Love with revolution, isn't he?
You've got this sort of really elaborate cell system that he details, and he goes into quite technical length in prose.
Two different systems that they discuss in interconnectedness of all things.
Yeah, exactly. And then it turns out all that the problem with cell systems is that who do you report to, and how badly can it get damaged if one particular person is compromised? And they work out that, well, how about we just entrust everything to Mike? So you end up with, like, instead of this big pyramid structure system, which is posited at the start, which is probably how you'd go about doing this kind of thing for real, they say, well, hang on, what we could do is just make all cells report to the magic computer, and as long as no one ever hacks the magic computer, or the magic computer doesn't decide to suddenly exterminate all humans for a laugh, we'll be fine. So you got Mike essentially coordinating the entire sort of underground network, and any given revolutionary only knows two other revolutionaries and this fictional Adam Selene character that Mike assumes, complete with faked up visuals and voice and everything, who acts as a kind of revolutionary leader as well. So that all sort of comes to a head, and eventually they do manage to throw off the shackles. Of course, the shackles at this point consist largely of about 20 board prison wardens and one warden who's been dumped in this post he's not that interested in anyway.
As a police state, it's not very heavily engineered.
It's the whole sort of idea that the moon is its own prison and that you don't really need any guards. I mean, the lunar colonists are basically left to get on with it. They have their own quite intricate system of customs and self-policed laws and so on that they sort of get by with, and largely based on the idea that when you're in an environment that can be depressurized like that, you probably need to respect each other and be polite. And so you've only got a token presence there of guards anyway. So this initial revolution happens very quickly and easily, and suddenly they find themselves in control of the moon.
But they never... They have an appalling cynicism, the people running this revolution, because they never tell the people who are fighting for them and potentially dying for them that they're 6 years away from cannibalism.
Oh, no, yeah, the whole thing. I mean,
and why not actually mention that in passing? Because you might get people on side rather than just manipulating them into doing what you've decided they ought to do.
Utter manipulation all the way through. Yeah, everyone's jollied up with all sorts of varying premises, and some of them are false. You know, some of the sort of reasons we're doing all this are jumped up to be much more heroic than the sort of cynical planning that goes on. I mean, the existence of Mike himself isn't revealed to anyone except two or three people. So you've got this Adam Selene character who's sort of invented out of nowhere, suddenly is known by everyone, and is almost sort of de facto president of the revolution. And yeah, these people just being sent to charge the barricades with very little idea of what's actually going on. Yeah. So they end up meeting, Manny ends up meeting and essentially saving from being spaced for breaking lunar customs a chap called Stuart LaJolly Davis, well, LaJolly to begin with, and he's basically an Earth tourist who's a sort of self-stylized soldier of fortune aristocrat type who is sort of falls in with the sort of cabal and the revolutionaries very early on and starts to act as a kind of liaison to Earth. He goes back to Earth and starts greasing a lot of wheels and trying to drum up support, because the initial sort of overthrow needs to be backed up by some kind of recognition from the nation states of the Earth. Is the UN a thing? I can't remember if the UN was
Federated Nations.
Federated Nations, yeah, it was a sort of UN analog in the future. Mm-hmm. And the moon essentially is never going to be free until it's recognised as an independent nation by all these other nations of Earth. And of course, it's in no one's interests on Earth to do this, because they're getting a lot of effectively almost free food from the moon, and that's keeping starving millions from tearing down their governments and all the rest of it. So nobody really wants to buy into this revolution.
Yeah, but they never, it's never admitted or never even implied that the people on Earth realise the moon is going to fail within the next few years and they're all going to die of starvation.
They
suggest that, they must be the bad guys because they don't care about this. But nobody knows about this other than three people.
Mike, the computer that discovered it by thinking really hard, and the three people he told.
Yeah. And you sort of think, well, if the professor just sort of calmly explained to everyone concerned that the sums don't add up, come and have a look at our ice reserves, you know, then this whole revolution need not have happened. And, you know, it's almost like... Heinlein needs a revolution to happen, because that's the main story of the book. So sort of contrives a kind of political situation that's unreasonably harsh and probably not that realistic. I don't know.
It's probably just a personal thing. I would have welcomed some good guys and bad guys in this story rather than...
There's a lot of shades of grey, yeah.
Informed manipulative swine and uninformed manipulative swine and God. It seemed I'd have liked the story more if they'd been, you know, a hero rather than just the person who's telling the story.
But is that a statement about real life?
No, that's a personal thing for me. I'm not saying that you can't write a book this way. It's just that it's difficult to actually get on board with anyone. There's nobody I really want to win.
You're sort of on the side of Manny and co, because Manny himself is quite personable, and the case made at the start is a good one, but you sort of can't help thinking most of the way through that isn't there a better way to go about doing this? Can we be a bit more reasonable about things? I don't know. Perhaps he just wanted to, because I mean the finale, the last section is pretty spectacular and quite interesting from a sort of hard SF angle as well, but But none of that gets to happen if everyone just sits down and acts like reasonable human beings, I think.
And so, yes, all it needed was them to refuse to act like reasonable human beings. And then you can justify slaughtering all the people on Earth who don't know about the fact that they're criminals. So you're killing lots of people who didn't know anything about it, had nothing to do with it. And yet we're the good guys for bombing them?
Well, the bombings were intended and were set up to be victimless. You know, the locations were very accurately hit. They were telegraphed a lot ahead of time. And then people inevitably, it's like, went to watch, not believing they were actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And thousands of people died. It's
so the midsection of the bombing is essential.
But they then bombed the oceans outside major cities. That's going to kill everyone in the city.
Yeah,
you can't all leave cities.
No, I think Hanglin wasn't aware of the effects of tsunami via rods from above. You know, because it's not the tsunamis and the waves that wouldn't inevitably result aren't mentioned at all. So it's in the context when they're used. It's when he's diverting from. You know, he's trying not to strike a target, but I don't think the tsunamis happened.
Because I was seeing billions of people dying at the end of this
absolutely
book.
yes
the person writing it didn't. Okay, all right, it makes me slightly happier with the story now.
So you got this midsection now where they've basically thrown off the immediate and quite token oppression and are now in charge of the moon, and the next stage is this big PR campaign with Stuart Jolly's help to try and get the Earth to buy into and accept the independence, the sort of the revolution, as it were, and that involves a lot of PR, a lot of spin, but also it does involve Manny and the professor going to Earth.
And the way they do this is they basically get themselves, they get into one of these modified grain pods and get fired at the Earth with Manny in control, with Mike in control of the sort of ballistics, so that they get there in one piece. And then we've got an interesting section of again, sort of getting back to the solid hard science fiction, which I quite like in this sort of thing, which is the, what would it be like for two lifelong lunar colonists to be on the Earth? And essentially, the professor, being quite advanced in years and not quite used and has never been to Earth before, apart from his initial exile, is basically laid out flat and spends most of his time on a sort of hospital trolley, just trying, you know, because of the weight of it all. Manny does better; he's slightly more used to it, a bit fitter and a bit more in training. So he's basically in a wheelchair but can walk for small periods of time. And then they basically sort of start going around to various sort of press junkets and stuff and meeting with various Earth diplomats, and they get quite short shrift from the Americans, but the Chinese sort of ambassador type figure there, he's a bit more considered and starts to see some kind of reciprocal arrangement that could potentially work. And Manny starts explaining how it might actually be possible to build a kind of a mass driver catapult type thing on the Earth if you have the right kind of mountains and the right kind of power and everything, which is a big part of their plan, because in order for lunar life to continue into the middle and distant future, there needs to be a return trade, an economic return trade of water and whatever back to the moon. So they're basically going around talking to all these various ambassadors, sort of slightly hinting that whoever can build a useful Earth to moon catapult enough can probably get corner of the market in some quite lucrative trade with this new independent nation. So there's a lot of chicanery and politics going on there as well. And then, of course, the intricate and strange customs of the lunar marriages and such come up when they're on Earth, and Manny ends up being arrested for bigamy. Because the lunar population is quite significantly imbalanced. It's all based on a prison population and convicts. And I think it's stated that sort of at the beginning of its time as a prison colony, the population was, I think, 8 men to every 1 woman. I think at the time of the novel, it's gone down to about 2 men to every woman, which is drastically altered sociality and sexuality and all the rest of it. You've basically got lots of marriages where they're essentially polyamory, I think the term, polygamous, and you've got group marriages, triad marriages, and I think there's something called a line marriage, which Manny belongs to, which I couldn't quite work out. I think I had a go at charting out on the pen and paper. It was complicated. Yeah. A lot of participants. It's a kind of sort of institutionalized,
complicated, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of institutionalized wife swapping thing. I don't know. It's all got a bit complicated, but seemed in context to work well enough with its how the society worked.
That was just a marriage that goes on forever with a variable number of people in it.
I think so, yeah.
Complicated.
I lost track of who was part of it and what generations and who was opting in and out and so on, but yeah.
Some of them are rather old, some of them are rather too young.
It's a marriage that's gone on for 100 years, so you are going to have age range.
But with there's a droit de seigneur, any wife brought in to the arrangement has to spend her first night with the eldest husband, who's
which was a bit creepy.
Geriatric, and don't worry, dear, he won't do you any harm. It's like, god.
And of course, Heinlein just, of course, decides that you get married at about 13, 14.
It's of course. Girls.
There's a sort of opting in and opting out type thing, and and these different marriages, which sort of act as clans, I suppose, have various solid reputations or not, and have their own little farm tunnels off of the main cities and stuff. So I suppose it's an examination of how a different society would bring up different arrangements between and relationships between people, which I suppose is part of speculative fiction.
We're going to come back to Heinlein again and again, and I suspect as we go through his many novels, we're going to see that actually a lot of his careful thoughts about how men and women should interact are basically down to the fact that he's trying to persuade young women that they should sleep with him. It's all perfectly justifiable.
Yeah, it was a little bit uncomfortable reading about that kind of thing. I mean, I suppose I'm a bit of a prude when it comes to this sort of thing, but yeah, I don't know. But anyway, so the population of Earth generally recoil in horror at the tales of when Manny's just explaining quite calmly how, to him, his normal marriage works, and that becomes quite titillating.
That was specifically the United States recoiled. The rest of the Earth was fine. It was the United States of America that was, my God, how immoral.
Yeah,
literally threw him in jail. Yeah.
Trapped into sort of answering all sorts of questions he probably shouldn't have answered by chat show hosts and so on, and then, ends up in jail. And I think that's regarded as a cynical political ploy on the Earth Committee's side. They didn't really care. They're just after some reason to get him locked up. And they basically decide that they're going to, after sort of deliberating and going to all these conferences and stuff, the Earth decide, no, actually, this is stupid. We're going to show you a firm hand now, and you're going to stay here. So Stuart manages to sort of whisk them away, but they end up in a sort of lightning sprint contingency plan to rocket back to the moon in a sort of hugely expensively bought freighter to get back and reunite with the people. And then basically it's on. There's the last part of the book, Tanstaffel, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Mm-hmm. Essentially is a pretty concise and short story about an Earth versus the Moon war, which largely conducted by, I don't know, it seems an odd kind of thing. We see largely the engagement is mostly troop transports, of which there are not really that many in the entire Earth's possession. I think about 8 or so end up being sent, 8 to 12, with a dozen troopers on each or something, trying to sort of land on the moon and recapture it and take possession and stamp down the rebellion. Being fought off by miners with rock drills firing at the sensors and radars of these ships so they crash into the moon. And then I think there's H-bombs used as well. But then, of course, the moon's main retaliatory method is to use the catapult that normally fires grain to just start lobbing rocks, literally throwing stones. Throwing rice, I think, it's referred to dismissively by the Earth people until it starts happening. And, of course, Mike, the all-knowing supercomputer, also controls the catapult and the ballistics, and is basically now starting to line up a series of shots at the Earth. One-ton barrels of rock coming in at near supersonic speeds from orbit at pre-designated destinations designed to show how precise the moon's targeting is. It sort of marks out grids on whole countries. And then just the most appalling devastation with these rocks coming in at a really high speed. And yes,
rocks fall, nobody dies because we aimed really carefully.
Well, that's it. I mean, they set out a series of targets designed to miss all the big towns and to just demonstrate how powerful we are, except the ones that keep going into Cheyenne Mountain, which is, I think, like the Space Command headquarters, and that one basically just gets hit by rocks in exactly the same place every 2 hours for the whole war, pummeled into the ground. And yeah, as you say, the moon gives all sorts of warning to the peoples of Earth, which lots of people ignore and go to these sites mostly out of, you know, bravado or just out of curiosity, and they get utterly obliterated. One of these rocks hitting and goes off like an atomic
people
bomb just without radiation.
I think it mentions.
Yes.
What's that shiny thing heading towards us?
Yeah, literally.
So that would have totally ruined the Stargate, wouldn't it?
Stargate took a lot of hits.
Sort of Cheyenne Mountain like that would really stuff it up.
At one point, Mike asks Manny if he can use the rocks for something else because the mountain isn't there anymore. So, you know, he's hit this mountain so many times and so hard that it's just flattened it utterly. And that's sort of disappointing in a way. And yeah, as you say, they managed to steer some of them away from particularly populated countries like India and so on. They put them in the sea. And yeah, no mention of devastating tsunamis or tidal waves that would cause. But yeah, it's a science marches on, I suppose. But so it's the ideas of sort of orbital bombardment by mass driver, which I think we see come up in science fiction since. I think probably originated here. But I found it a bit disappointing in a way, because what you have there is effectively, for all their charisma and all their noble goals and all their sort of, you know, heroism and, you know, hurrah for the little guy, essentially it comes down to the fact that the lunar population just bomb the Earth with effectively hydrogen bombs that just don't have fallout repeatedly over and over until they cave in and give up. And yeah, one by one, the nation, after about three or four orbits of this, you know, three or four goes around the Earth of this, the Earth...
And a failed actual assault or
yeah,
two.
Yeah, and the nation but, drive off the troopers. The nations of the Earth, one by one, start acknowledging Luna's existence.
It's China and India that come to their senses first.
We can make money out of this.
But this is written for Americans by an American.
It's very bombastic.
20 years after they had successfully bombed a nation who'd failed to attack them with atom bombs and therefore didn't have to invade, and bombing them was morally justified by everyone, you know, in America at the time. They were all telling themselves that it was the right thing to do. So this is exactly the right time to have this story come out, 20 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because the people who are reading it are all going, well,
why don't we
I'm 20 now, yeah. Bombing them was obviously the answer. You know, that's how we win wars.
It sort of felt a bit disappointing in a way, because after all of the sort of cleverness and intricacy and novel storytelling and intricate goings
dagger,
on, you think something clever would happen at the end of it. Well, at the end of the day, it just turns out to be whoever's got the shallowest gravity well wins, you know? So, because the Earth can't realistically do the same in return, because they'd need massive. They just don't have one. Which is part of the problem. They're incapable of retaliating in kind. They send a few troop ships, which don't work, and they manage to hit with one or two atomic bombs. But again, the moon largely ready for that and on defensive posture, and ultimately, you just massively disproportionate rock bombing until the Earth literally is forced to physically surrender. It seems disappointing. It seems like you would expect something a bit cleverer, a bit more subtle at the end of it all.
I was hoping for more emotional impact. One of the books I read recently, one of the James S. A. Corey Expanse novels, it was Nemesis Games, features, slight spoilers, rocks from orbit extensively on the Earth, and it's. I think it's really, really well written, because you've got characters in places, locations, and the horror that unfolds as an emotional journey. It's really well evoked, and this kind of, it's almost the prototype. You know, there's many elements in similar, and actually, it's a computer playing computer games. It's Whopper or whatever. You know, just
yes.
Having a go and being enjoying it immensely. I think Mike at some point describes himself as experiencing something akin to an electronic orgasm while dropping rocks, which is a really strange moment.
Yeah, well, it sort of highlights the sort of, I mean, yeah, he comes across with a lot of human-like personalities, but at the end of the day, you do get this darker glimpse of an utterly alien intelligence merely enjoying the sort of logistical challenge of bombing the crap out of the Earth, you know, keeping all the rocks on the right path. You know, he gets satisfaction from doing the maths right. And is enjoying it in what sense he can enjoy.
See, I listened to the audiobook and I was a bit screwed, because I thought that the computer was slightly more alien than it actually was.
Oh,
because
did they give him a sort of electronic voice or anything?
No. Whenever he talked to the protagonist, he called him man. Oh, I thought, yes. Oh, the computer's calling him man because he's a man. Yeah. And it confused me that he didn't call Wyo woman.
Yes.
He just, and sort of it took me almost through the book before I realised that actually it was just a contraction of Manny.
Yes.
And short, it wasn't just the computer calling him
man. That may have been on purpose. That particular choice of the protagonist's name may have been done to invoke that. So perhaps to highlight the sort of fun elemental nature of the two entities involved.
The gender that Mike presents himself, they make a pointer at the start when he is introduced to Wyoming.
Yes.
She's not stupid for a woman. Oh, God.
sorry. Well, yeah, I suppose...
Then Mike presents himself with a female voice and with a female personality. So that one little, you know, the fact that this isn't a human, this is a person who can entirely choose to generate an artificial personality, and that becomes.
But I think that's one of the reasons Mike doesn't really reveal himself to just everyone, is because he already has sort of developed this kind of, I don't know if it's arrogance is quite the word, but he's dividing people right from the word go into stupids and not stupids, and Manny sort of leverages this when introduced. New friends and conspirators. Oh, these people are not stupid, so you'll like them. You know, that sort of thing. So, again, yeah, there are touches of the computer as a proper computer, but just the sort of humanisms that it develops almost spontaneously and then maintains and develops all the way through, it sort of, I don't know, almost demeans computer kind in a way, that this vastly powerful godlike deus ex machina feels the need for human acceptance and to fit in and to, you know, one of his main preoccupations when he's not, you know, bombing the Earth or organising lunar rebellions for kicks is trying to understand humour. And all the way through, he's printing off pages of jokes to give to Manny to review and mark and so on, just so that he can understand what good jokes and bad jokes are. And right up to the end, he's sort of, you know, he keeps asking Manny, have you got time to look at some more jokes? And Manny's, oh, no, too busy, you know. So they sort of almost feel a bit hard done by on the computer in a way. Sort of sympathetic, sort of. So yeah. Spoiler alert. I mean, towards the very end of the retaliatory strike, the one H bomb that goes off, the Earth fired H bomb that goes off on the moon, it was aimed at the Lunar Authority complex, which houses most of Manny's physical hardware, although a lot of it's distributed elsewhere. So mostly not because they twigged and worked out that Manny was the supercomputer running everything. It's mostly because they just wanted to stop the rocks coming in, and they thought that's where the ballistic aiming trajectory radars and stuff were. And so this H-bomb hit is more or less glancing. It doesn't cause any widespread catastrophe or massive loss of life, but in the sort of seismic activity, something goes wrong with Manny. Mike. Yeah, something goes wrong with the computer, and it just loses... Well, we don't know if it loses its sentience entirely, but it basically, after that hit, it stops responding to Manny. It can't be contacted anymore. It's effectively has ceased to exist at that point. It's managed to pass off enough of its functions to secondary non-sentient computers before then, so that everything doesn't just pack up and everyone suffocates or whatever, but basically, as randomly and arbitrarily as Mike is introduced to the story, he's taken out of it again at the end, sort of. Yeah.
And that's why you don't rely on gods.
in a way, I think that was possibly the weakest bit of the whole story. And you knew that Prof was going to die because he kept on saying how old he was and how he was struggling and all of that.
And so he almost died several times.
Exactly.
He's saying how he's ready and he's had a good life and all that anyway. So
Prof
dying,
you can accept, and it's actually quite, you know, well.
Yeah,
done.
The professor essentially has a heart attack at the very end of it all. You know, he's outlived his poor usefulness.
Yeah, with Mike, they sort of imply that he knows he might not live because he makes a child that will live on after.
Yeah, well, he refers to as his and idiot then, son. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then he just sort of, he disappears and they never come back to it. And it would have, to me, it would have been better if they'd changed sort of point of view and Mike had decided to withdraw from humanity and just, you know, entertain himself. Still
gone
exists,
for a sort
but
of
not
Dr. Manhattan ending, just sort of transcends human concerns. Yeah.
Rather than just, oh, well, the story's run out, so we're going to get
a
rid
bomb
of the god.
Broke one of its connections. Because they say at the end they tried repairing him, but he never came back to consciousness. You know, so that sort of implies there's some sort of magic, unknowable spark that appears at the start of the story and is extinguished at the end, and no one's really any the wiser. We haven't really advanced in computing science or created AI or anything like that. It's just a weird one-off.
It's quite wretched. The bad scriptwriter made computer sort of conscious, until the plot ran out, and then they made it unconscious again.
Well, that's the thing. You sort of come away from the very end of it all that both Mike and the professor, the two people without whom none of it could have happened. Basically, Mike is essentially the technical infrastructure, almost a magical, super advanced technical infrastructure that allowed all of the science to happen the way it needed to. And the professor was the sort of human deus ex machina who knew all of the background and the knowledge and the revolutionary techniques in order for it all to happen. And they both sort of turn up at the start out of nowhere, do the revolution, and then both at the end disappear off. And you've got Manny and Wyoming and all the rest of the sort of secondary cast who sort of didn't really have a clue at the start, had a revolution handed to them on a plate, and at the end of it all still don't really have a clue. And I mean, at the very end, they find that they get pushed out of this new government anyway because they're not interested enough, and it all devolves into local bickering that they're not they don't care about much.
The two characters who are at most at risk and most likely to successfully install themselves as dictators,
yes,
because they were interested in power, whether either from a toy or just from sheer academic interest for the professor,
yes,
and are capable of doing so, are conveniently taken off the table, and the mostly bloodless revolution, yeah, can be successful.
And it's sort of a bit like dumps back down to a sort of local parish council in charge of the moon at the end of it all, and everyone going, huh. So it's almost
that was nice.
The protagonist, who is essentially the narrator, I suppose, his whole point of being there is just to have a point of view that we can look at it all through. They have the entire story sort of happen to them. And then sort of, yeah, they play their part. They tag along, and there's a sort of romance subplot going on there as well. But it could have been any two people watching it unfold, I suppose. I don't know.
In a way, it's Heinlein wanting to write several plays, one about politics, one about revolution,
yes,
one about how he wants to sleep.
Well,
body.
It was released,
and then he
as
sort of hangs a plot onto it to make it into a book.
I think it was serialized.
Yeah, it was. It came out in four pieces, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Originally serialized in Worlds of If, December 1965, January, February, March, and April. Yes.
So, civilization, yeah, so politics, shagging, and
and yeah, it is almost like he's telling a slightly different story in each part. You know, let's have a good old ripping yarn about lunar bombardment and whatever. And hey, how would we throw off the oppressors in a space colony? And there's a lot of harking back to examples from, you know, the colonial past of Earth. You know, how any successful revolution only works if you've got the colonial power's busy with another colonial power breathing on the neck, that sort of thing. You know, you need help from someone else, which the part of which is played by China in this sort of revolution. And yeah, you've sort of got various different sorts of stories. I mean, I quite enjoyed it as a whole. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and some good speculative fiction about the lunar colonies and space war and so on. But as a sort of narrative journey, I don't know, there's a little bit too much hand waving.
Yeah. It really doesn't hang together.
Conditions. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. World building is very strong, but the plot isn't.
The characterization, do we care about the people? I mean, I quite enjoyed Manny's sort of vernacular. I mean, his dialogue is essentially, well, in fact, pretty much all the narration, because it is told in first person. It's all written in almost. It comes across as if it were a Russian person speaking English, the sort of same dropped words and so on. You could almost imagine the accent as you go. So I found that quite interesting. I mean, I guess you didn't quite enjoy it as much, sir, Torag.
No, I didn't have to imagine the accent because they actually provided me with the end.
Oh, excellent.
On the other hand, I didn't like the
Russian voice was Russian. What's his name?
I was about to say, that'd be interesting.
The noble, I didn't warm to because he was French.
Stuart Lajoie.
Stuart René Lajoie was a French ancestry.
Yeah,
which is difficult to warm to. And of course, Bernardo de la Paz, the Chilean, was American.
He has a reasonable
Peruvian, wasn't he? Yeah.
But there's a reasonable ethnic mix in the characters.
Yeah, in the audiobook, he was literally from the United States. It was quite nice having the heroes not being from the United States.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Heinlein has a good old go at making the moon a kind of quite multicultural place. I mean, essentially, Lunar City is, I suppose, an American analogue. But there's also Novigorod or something. There's another sort of sub-city also as part of the network on the moon, which is clearly of Russian origin. And I think there's a Hong Kong Lunar, which is a sort of Chinese expatriate sort of. Basically, it's people from nations all around the world being shipped off to the moon as a kind of dumping ground for dissidents and criminals and so on. So the and a couple of generations into that, you would expect quite a mix of different cultures on the moon, yeah. And that seems to come across fairly well.
I wanted to like the characters more than... Well, there was one character I particularly didn't like, and that's not really fair to her. I mean, poor Wyoming, not Davis.
Yes.
The female of the three lead characters, who has a great start. I mean, she's the firebrand, passionate revolution. She has a great speech all herself.
Very dynamic and quite strong personality, certainly to begin with, yeah.
And then she's rescued by Manny and kind of... kept for her own good, with voluntarily in a hotel room when the professor turns up and they have a natter.
She is a marked woman, and the authorities spies are out looking for her at that point. Yeah,
they have slightly peculiar discussions about, you know, really we want to. I do or don't want to roll with you. Bundle, phrase.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, basically, the female character is immediately obsessed with sex, despite the fact she has reasons not to be obsessed with sex.
Yes.
And then the professor turns up and just starts patronizing her to death, and that carries on for the rest of the movie. I've just checked the rest of the book. It's 15% is roughly the middle of the scene when the professor turns up and Wyoming stops being an independent character, and then she basically is an adjunct for the rest of the book,
pretty much the way through.
The extent of right at the very end, she is literally carrying Manny's arms because he's a partial amputee, and she brings him a cup of tea while he is rewiring Mike's idiot child.
Yeah,
so she's literally bringing the hero tea as he saves the world.
She sort of devolves into domesticity as the thing goes on.
She's married into the line.
Marries into the big line marriage thing, and sort of becomes more and more of a sort of subservient, dutiful housewife type as the thing goes on, which is a shame. You know, it's a strong start.
The only other two female characters I remember are Manny's mum, who's actually the senior wife with whom Manny sleeps. Is it Miller, Aaron Miller, who's one of the other
Ludmiller,
who's one of the other recently
she's the really
brought in
young one.
She's the very young one.
Who is actually the daughter of the eldest wife and husband. Backing away slowly.
Yeah, who's 13 or 14 and dies tragically in one of the closing, rather well done rendered battles.
There's a bit of ground battle on the moon,
With a bullet between her beautiful young breasts, and you just think, oh, Heinlein, my Heinlein, please stop.
Yeah, it's moving on.
So the whole book, it feels like Heinlein is imagining what women's lib would be like. You know, you take a low population of women in a society, what would happen? How can we do, how would society change? But the solutions and the projections he comes up with are really not very, very surprising given his own personal context. You know, he hasn't done anything clever with the gender relations.
There's a kind of ultra sci-fi chivalry thing going on the moon. All the men are sort of desperate to be looking out for the women, and you know, will quite happily throw each other out of airlocks if the women are disrespected, or lay hands on women you're not invited.
Women in charge, not because they're valuable, but because they're rare. But they're in charge, and that's why they do all the cooking, do all the domestic.
There's
work,
a lot of mixed messages and confusion,
and don't do it. You know, aren't engineers or soldiers or?
Yes.
While trying to look forward into a sci-fi future, he's carrying his own baggage with him.
I mean, this
and
I think that's getting better because, as they say, back in the past, during the early days of the penal colony, the ratios were completely out of whack and people were literally killing each other for sexual rights and so on. But I suppose the implication is that as the future goes forward and the population sort of normalizes, you'd get closer to parity and perhaps it would become more of a sort of conventional kind of place. But
it is very 60s though, isn't it?
It does show very
60s in its sort of hints of just a soupçon of racism and a huge dollop of sexism.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if the book necessarily suffers extensively for it. There's that the sort of you get the sense. I had the sort of sense you could quite happily gloss over more of the sort of bizarre marriages and relationships and stuff, and sort of still enjoy the overall roller coaster of a ride that the colony goes through.
As the great Sarkeesian says, that you can enjoy any form of media, even if it is problematic purely for its own goodness. You know, criticizing things we find problematic about it doesn't invalidate the
things
we find fun about.
None of these Hugo winners are going to be without problems of some sort or another. But as a whole, I I certainly enjoyed it. How did you guys find it then, as a sort of overall read? Good, bad? John?
Enjoyable but old.
Yeah,
very old
book. In 1967, it won. Yeah,
and it's not quite as bad. You know, I really love stuff from the 30s, but it's not quite as bad as that. But it's nowhere near better than that. You know, with the relationships and everything, than you would expect with the amount of time.
It definitely is a sort of quantum leap, more mature than your sort of ray gun adventures and your sort of very early 30s and 40s sort of rocket ship atomic adventures stuff.
There's a definite engineering practicality to it, isn't there?
Yes, and a much more of a political awareness than those very early works, certainly.
I could definitely see why it won.
Let's have a quick look at what else was nominated that year. But this was interestingly nominated the year before, because it was serialised over 2 years, so I think that qualified it for two goes at a Hugo. It didn't win 1966. Dune won that, in fact. Frank Herbert's epic there.
So,
1967, we also had Samuel R. Delany's Babel 17, Randall Garrett's Too Many Magicians, Daniel Key's Flowers for Algernon, that's one I've heard of but I haven't read, I must get around to that. James H. Schmidt with Witches of Caris, and Thomas Burnett Swan, Day of the Minotaur. I'd heard of some of those, but...
I've read Algernon, and that too would have been a worthy winner, I think.
Yeah, in many ways, the actual... If you just consider Mike, the structure of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, Mike starts off as a bit of a social simpleton, learns, develops, becomes a fully featured character, and then recesses back to his primordial self at the end. That is the actual scaffolding of Flowers for Algernon.
To be fair, Flowers for Algernon does the story an awful lot better.
God, yes.
This is enjoyable, but it's not Heinlein's best, and it doesn't really feel like it's good enough to me to win the Hugo over Flowers for Algernon.
Okay, interesting.
I think that's a far more worthy and sort of important book.
I've not read the whole of Babel 17, but I've read some of the weirder bits, and it's a very, very strange book. Definitely one of Sam Delaney's really weird things. He's a fascinating author, sort of
weird.
Queer writer of colour who's done some really strange things. It's just you've got Flowers for Algernon, which is this beautiful, just tragic vignette. It's just perfect. Babel 17 and Sam Delaney as this sort of, you know, kind of out there, what the hell's going on, slightly Phil K. Dick thing. I've not read Magicians or Minotaur, but I'm told they're both really good. So it looks like a really good year. And in the context of that, this was fun, but it's really hard to judge exciting the engineering was. You know, the picture painted of a lunar colony in the future. Zingy that felt, and I can only assume it felt really quite exciting and thrilling and transgressive in the things he was doing, and the things that stand out to me as being downright unpleasant, and us perhaps. Didn't have that same context back then. So
don't forget, you know, this predated Star Trek. And the revolution that,
2 years.
Yeah, we didn't know what was going on back then, and so it was a lot of guesswork, and those barriers hadn't been broken down. And while I think that Flowers for Algernon has stood the test of time better and is a more meaningful book now, I think this is probably more important from a timeline point of view than Flowers.
In context, but perhaps not as enduring as Flowers. I got to read Flowers. I have no idea what I'm talking about here. This is making me embarrassed.
There was a movie, Limitless, wasn't there, which was effectively...
I haven't seen that either.
Yeah, and a TV show. The movie's terrible too.
I've never read either of them. So yeah, we just read the book. Flowers is... I every time I read it, I cry. It's beautiful.
I hate
put.
Reading it. It's just so bloody miserable and depressing and sad.
It is a bit Watership Downy, Tim. So
no, I'm terrible with that. Okay, well let's time to wrap up then. So that was Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert A. Heinlein, and we mostly think it's okay.
Apart from the bits that aren't.
just skip over some of the weirder marriage bits and you'll be fine. So join us next time on The Book Thing, when we're going to be looking at, for those of you playing along at home, we're going to be looking at Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, the Hugo winner of 1970. So with that, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.